before you drink. What you get isn't always what you think.
Beers of Alaska, beer on the last frontier. Beers of Alaska, learn about them here.
Well, don't settle for the first, for it might be the worst.
Hello and welcome to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. As always, thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. We've got a lot of good stuff for you this month, but let's get started with beer news. Grace Ridge Brewery closed its doors on Saturday, September 11th, as part of its move to its new location at 870 Smoky Bay Way in Homer. As of this time, no opening date at the new location has been set. Two Alaska breweries earned medals in this year's U.S. Open Beer Championship. Cooper Landing Brewing Company earned bronze medals for its Schooner Bend Common and its Beer Admiral Smoked Porter. 49th State Brewing Company earned silver medals for its The Intrepid Stout in the Barrel Age Strong Beer category and its Prospector's Gold in the International Pilsner category. Over 8,000 different beers were submitted to this year's competition. 49th State Brewing was also the only brewery in our state to take home a medal from this year's Great American Beer Festival Awards. It earned a bronze medal for its The Intrepid Stout in the Wood and Barrel Age Strong Beer category. Judging took place in 34 sessions over 17 days. A total of 170 judges evaluated 9,680 entries from 2,192 breweries from all 50 states, plus Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico. At a 9,000-year-old burial site in China called Kuiato, archaeologists recently unearthed a number of ceramic vessels. Dartmouth College anthropologist Zhangjing Wang and his colleagues wondered whether these early clay vessels might have once held beer. Bits of the residue left inside 8 of the 13 pots turned out to contain phytoliths, which are fossilized plant remains, from rice, tubers, and a plant called Job's Tears. Starch molecules in the residue showed signs of being heated and fermented. Wang and his colleagues also found yeast and mold, key ingredients in fermentation. Quote, "Our results revealed that the pottery vessels were used to hold beer in the most general sense, a fermented beverage made of rice, a grain called Job's Tears, and unidentified tubers. This ancient beer, though, would not have been like the IPA that we have today. Instead, it was likely a slightly fermented and sweet beverage, which was probably cloudy in color," said Wang. "This cloudy, sweet rice beer would have been the product of a considerable amount of work. Around 9,000 years ago, people in southern China were just starting to farm rice. The Shangshan culture had seen its people settling in villages, but most of them still relied on hunting and foraging for much of their food. Evidence from other archaeological sites tells us that tubers and acorns were the staples of most people's diets. Rice appears to have been a luxury crop at the time, and rice beer, considering the extra effort and time required to make it, would have been reserved for very special occasions. In this case, someone buried these drinking vessels in several pottery pits dug into a large burial platform. An 80-meter-long, 50-meter-wide, 3-meter-high flat mound of earth surrounded by a 10 to 15-meter-wide, 2-meter-deep ditch. The platform was the final resting place of at least two people whose skeletons lay near the pottery pits. All this indicates that the special occasion at Kwiato was probably a funeral or a later ritual to honor the dead. The people who attended the ritual at Kwiato had their rice and tuber beer in vessels befitting the occasion. The ceramics found in the platform were finely made and decorated with a white slip formed by an outer layer of white clay. A few of them had been painted with abstract patterns of lines and dots, making the Kwiato drinking vessels the oldest painted pottery that archaeologists know of. At another Shangshan site called Zhihao, the archaeologists previously found traces of a different beer recipe, which included rice, honey, and fruits. Wang and his colleagues say that more chemical analysis of the beer residues on the vessels may reveal whether the beer also included honey or fruit. That's it for this month's beer news. Next, we'll have Adam Keel of Latitude 65 Brewing.
Hey everybody, this is Murphy with the Veritas Variety Review. I just wanted to let you guys know that we're moving from Wednesdays over to Saturdays, so we hope to see you every Saturday at 7 to 9 p.m. for some good tunes and some giggles. Catch you later.
Up next, we've got an interview with Adam Keel, the brewer and co-founder of Lat 65 Brewing in Fairbanks. Adam, how are you doing today, sir?
Pretty darn good, Bill.
Sounds good. So, hey, what's up in Fairbanks?
Yeah, it's been going pretty good. We've been open, I think it was 4 months yesterday, and we've been seeing pretty good success, especially considering our construction. It's been going on all around us. We're kind of in the brunt of a major road construction project. It's like Steeson Third. It's been like completely like shut down. The road to get to our brewery was completely shut down about, I think it was 2 weeks after opening. So it made it very difficult to get over here, but people are still fighting the traffic, and the traffic patterns change all the time, so you can't even rely on is like, how do you get to the brewery today? Like I've literally gone to the brewery one morning and it was a certain traffic pattern and I couldn't even leave the same way that I got here. But we've been weathering it pretty well.
That's a testament to the quality of your beer if people are willing to brave the road construction to get there. I guess this is what they say in Fairbanks is only two seasons, winter and road construction.
Yeah, we're going to be releasing a new beer that's basically named after the road construction, calling it Construction Never Ends.
What style is it?
It's a New England-ish style IPA.
Okay.
So it's fallen into the hazy beer category. It's 7.3%, and it's kind of actually, I guess, talking about something new. It's basically based off of our kind of, we've done another one, and it was similar base where mostly two-row barley, a whole lot of malted oats, a little bit of flaked oats, and a little bit of wheat. But like this one, I'm messing around with, I got some Nelson Sauvin hops, so it's just purely dry hopped with Nelson and using a new type of yeast from Omega Labs out of Chicago called Cosmic Punch. It supposedly exploits like the free thiols that are bound up in grain, and it can produce very similar aroma and flavor compounds that like New Zealand hops do, especially something like Nelson.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, I was going to try it in combination so I wouldn't have to dry hop the living daylights out of it like some of the cool kids do on these styles of beer. The amount of dry hopping some people do in this is insane. And, you know, I think it's a better cost-saving thing to try to reduce the amount of dry hopping as possible. But then also, I think it makes ultimately a better beer, so you don't have to like sit on it as long, so that hop bite,
right,
you know, settles out. It makes more sense to give something like this a try for making a beer in that profile range. And, you know, coming from a homebrewing background, it's always fun to experiment and try new things.
So you guys are still selling exclusively out of your tap room, right?
Almost exclusively. Like, we had beer on at the Foo Fighters concert up here in Fairbanks. That was really the like the first major thing we've had beer outside of the brewery. They had a salmon bake put on a beer and wine festival at Pioneer Park. And that was the first thing we've actually, that was the first time you had the beer outside of the brewery.
Yeah, I know you were down here for the Peninsula Fair too in Anilchik.
Yeah. That was another big jump for us. And but outside of that, like the Salmon Bake has had a little bit of the beer, and Tent City has gotten a little here and there.
I believe I saw some on the last time I was in Tent City. I can't remember now which one of yours they had on, but I remember they had something on. So that's cool.
We're kind of getting to a point where I feel like, all right, things we kind of know about the flow of things, and it's like, all right, we can send some beer out to more places if they so desire to have it on. I mean, our approach is like, you know, we're not going to force our beer out into the world.
And I understand you're just back from the Craft Brewers Conference in Denver.
Yeah, that was interesting seeing something like that going on after so much for COVID. But, it was like when you were inside, everybody had to be masked up and everything. But it was, so it's kind of hard to see who's who there. Like, do I know you or not? Kind of a thing with seeing old friends and stuff like that. It certainly made it a little more difficult in terms of socializing. But I always go mostly for the talks and everything like that. I think probably the biggest one, which is kind of an eye-opener one for me, was one on basically adjunct stouts. So generally what people are referred to as pastry stouts now. So they had a panel of some brewers that are pretty well known for it. Three main ones that I was aware of in advance were Monk's in California and Weldworks in Colorado, and even Three Floyds, an old time brewer. You know, it's interesting hearing their different perspectives and how still more old school Three Floyds is, and like the different perspectives. It's like how there is more refrained. And like people like Weldworks are doing like some pretty crazy stuff. Like one, like they said they were doing up to a 36-hour boil on one of their stouts, which is mind-blowing to me. Yeah. they claim they're just doing it for mouthfeel. But yeah, some of those techniques for dealing with using all sorts of ingredients after the beer is fermented, basically, and like stuff like coconut and there's all sorts of stuff, like the range of things that people are adding in these stouts.
Yeah, I think most of my experience with most of that sort of stuff is a lot of it is a real head killer. Is you start adding anything that's got any oil in it, it's going to really knock out your foam, right?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, like some of those, like that's, you know, there are things like they're trying to figure out, you know, how to keep some of that stuff going. Like a lot of those guys are actually pasteurizing beer now to make sure it's stable. Because for one, like they were talking about some of their finishing gravities were, you know, like 15 Plato. That's, you know, above an average
starting gravity
for a lot of beers.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that style. That's, again, not exactly my cup of tea. I guess I'm old fashioned enough, but put it on the shelf next to the hard seltzer.
I am partial to the more old school stuff. I mean, I do enjoy, I don't know if it's because I'm originally from the South, but I have a bit of a sweet tooth. So I do kind of enjoy some of the dessert elements of it. But it's like, when I feel like I'm drinking one of these pastry stouts, I don't feel like I'm actually drinking a stout. I feel like it's like dessert beer.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a stout base.
You certainly aren't going to have more than one.
Oh, yeah. Especially since a lot of these are, like the ones they were doing for the most part, they're in the neighborhood of like 15% alcohol sometimes.
Yeah. There was a beer that Southern Tier in New York put out. Like, I don't know if they still make it. I haven't seen it for a while, but it was a creme brulee stout. And that was
I know that one.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing, you know, you got a 22-ounce bottle. to me, if I was going to open one, I want to have four friends with me to share, because 4 or 5 ounces of that, that's about all I can handle. It's just so sweet and rich and everything. It's not the kind of beer that you're like, oh, let me sit down and drink a bottle of. It's just, there's just too much there to it.
And the funny thing is, it's like that was kind of like, by comparison to a lot of the pastry stouts now, that is
pretty tame
beer. Really, back in the old days, we were always told it's like, be subtle with it, because it's still beer. You know, you want like subtle hints of these things, so you still recognize the base style.
These days, I think subtle is out the window. I don't care what the style is. Everybody, if some is good, then too much must be better.
And it's to the point. It is like where, like, if you're trying something new for the first time, it's like, oh, well, if I go overboard with it, unless it's something, you know, like ridiculous, that would be like, I was like, oh, I'm adding too much cardamom or something like that. But in terms of like fruit additions or peanut butter or chocolate or anything like that, it's better to go more, because people do expect it. Like when you say it's got this in it, it needs to taste exactly like it. Say it's going to taste like a Reese's peanut butter cup, it darn well better.
Yeah.
Where people won't really take to it the same way they used to. Like used to, it was like, oh yeah, this kind of does taste like it. But now there's been several years of like, nope, this is a breakfast cereal and it tastes just like, you know, my childhood. Kind of refer to them as nostalgic.
Yeah. Maybe it'll circle back to tasting like beer.
It kind of is to some degree. I am seeing that happen. So like being down in Denver, there are 2 fairly large breweries in Denver that make just German beer, like Bierstadt and Prost. Went to both of them and they just make German beer. The wildest thing Bierstadt had on tap was a smoked Helles. You know, it's nice to see that. And there are more breweries, like just in the Great American Beer Festival this year, the Pilsner category grew considerably. I think in the next few years, I think there is going to be like a demand for some classic styles again, because they've gone away for so long. And it's almost going to be nostalgic again to have some of these classic styles that resurfaced at the beginning of the craft beer boom. And they've kind of waned off, and we've had all these just IPA and food flavored beers. I think there are going to be more people like, you know what? It's been a long time since I've had a brown ale.
I sure hope you're right. Any other news you'd like to share?
Well, one piece of news for the brewery is we are finally deciding to go into crowlers. It was something I was kind of advocating for from the beginning, but, you know, with all the delays, we just wanted to get open and have some money coming in instead of out for once. And now we have ordered a seamer and rounding up cans coming this way. And probably the biggest thing that'll keep us from doing it sooner is getting a label set up for it. But yeah, we're going to do the 25.4 ounce cans, which is a 750 milliliter can. Because, yeah, that's another thing. It's like we've had people like every day, some days it's almost like every other person that comes up that is in here for the first time, that they'll ask, do we have cans to go? And, of course, you know, we ran out of growlers, too, so it was even worse. We had 64-ounce and 32-ounce glass growlers, and we cannot get 32-ounce ones. Like, we just finally got a shipment in of the 64-ounce ones yesterday, but the suppliers, we're probably a month out best before we even get them to even be able to print them. So with that being the case, it was like, all right, it's definitely time to get these crowlers going. I feel like you might be seeing some of those cans floating their way down farther in the south as things do when that happens.
Great. That's good news.
Yeah. But I mean, it's mostly, I mean, we're going to be really treating it like a growler and how crowlers traditionally were. It was like more of an on-demand fill thing instead of it just being a cheaper packaging option. But I mean, even still, we're going to treat it like we would be, like if it was running a canning line, you know, CO2 purging the cans before filling and putting the end on foam and all that. So
That's great.
People do sit on them for too long, it has a better chance of it being a good representation of the beer. Because, you know, it's like I've done it myself. I'm like, oh, I still have a crowler from somewhere that got pushed back in the fridge because you're waiting to share this with somebody. And you end up drinking something else. And then it's like, oh, I have a crowler that's a month old.
Yep. Those are not going to be very representative of what the brewer is trying to show you. Anything else coming along?
Well, probably the biggest news is we are actually currently in the process of finding a replacement head brewer for me because my wife and I are moving to the lower 48 here pretty soon.
Oh, okay. Where are you guys headed in the lower 48?
Eureka, California.
Okay.
So if not familiar with that, that is a coastal town in the very northern part of California. A lot of people in the area kind of refer to it as like lower Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was reading something somewhere that it shared the same climate as Ketchikan, actually.
What kind of time frame are you looking at?
Well, with her job, I mean, she could very well start, it looks like, I mean, it could be the end of this month, possibly, then me kind of commute back and forth until we've got someone up here in place, because kind of a quick turnaround and a move to Alaska is not the easiest for some people, especially if they have a family.
Well, we wish you good luck in the search for a replacement, Adam. You're going to be missed up here, I can tell you that. But best of luck down in Eureka and chasing the dream, man.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, because there's only one brewery in Eureka right now, and it's basically about the same size kind of dynamic of Fairbanks. It's just on the coast, and crazy enough as it is, there's a whole lot less restrictions for breweries there.
Yeah.
And you could do so much more stuff there, and that's...
Yeah, let's not get started on the whole Alaska's
right
brewery
there.
Laws are. That, anyway... Well, hey, best of luck, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today. We really appreciate it, and I wish you every success in finding a replacement and going down to Eureka and making a fresh start.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, and thanks for having us on, and probably update you again when announce who our official new head brewer will be here in the coming months.
Absolutely. And, thanks great. A lot. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. We'll be right back with our next segment.
The Kenai Peninsula Food Bank distributes food to our neighbors throughout the entire Kenai Peninsula through a network of agencies and food pantries. Each $1 donated can purchase $10 worth of product through the Food Bank of Alaska and by buying bulk. Many people are struggling to make ends meet right now. Help the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank ensure that our neighbors have food. Visit kpfoodbank.org and donate to ensure that no one goes hungry.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Anyone out there who has listened to this program for any length of time probably realizes that I consider most liquor laws out there, especially those of our home state of Alaska, to be a scourge upon the land. Let's have a quick historical review. In the fervor during and immediately after World War I, the 18th Amendment was adopted, permitting Congress to outlaw alcohol, which it did with the Volstead Act, effective January 1, 1921. Prohibition was an abject failure. Many, many people still wanted to drink for fun, and organized crime got much more organized to fill that need. The ban was already well in the tank when the crash of 29 doomed it once and for all. Income tax went to nothing at the start of the Great Depression, and the feds, desperate for a new source of revenue, basically said, "Hey, what about that liquor tax that we gave up on back in 1920? Let's get back to that." The 21st Amendment, which repealed the 18th and left the regulating of alcohol to the individual states, was ratified on December 5, 1933. And what did that 13-year malfeasance teach those states? Not much. The American puritanical tendency to treat adults like children when it comes to adult beverages and other adult substances still stands front and center in many parts of the U.S. Politicians around this country seem to have delighted in devising the most ridiculous laws possible when it came to regulating the consumption of alcohol. Recently, I came upon a compilation of some of the more egregious of these rules, which I thought I would share with you. Here we go. Many of the Kentucky counties that have bourbon distilleries are dry counties, where sales and public consumption of alcohol are prohibited. That's right, millions of gallons of some of the best booze in the world is getting made in places where drinking is not legal. You can watch the entire process of some of the world's finest alcohol getting made, but you can't taste it or buy it. In Oklahoma, there's no going to a store for a cold one. If a store sells beer at over 4% alcohol by volume, it has to be sold at room temperature. In Alabama, a wine bottle may not have, quote, immodest or sensuous imagery, end quote, on the label. It's also illegal for a neon sign to advertise alcohol. And in Tuscaloosa, it's illegal to give alcohol to animals in a public park. In Texas, it really matters whether or not you're upright. You can only have 3 sips of beer while standing. If you're sitting, chug away. But 4 standing sips and you're busted, mister. Also, the entire Encyclopedia Britannica is banned there because it contains a formula for making beer at home. Nebraskans are fun. Bars can't sell beer unless they're cooking a pot of soup. In Maine, it's illegal to sell booze before 9 a.m. on Sundays, except if St. Patrick's Day falls on a Sunday, in which case you can start buying at 6 a.m. In Vermont, state law prohibits carrying or drinking alcohol while dancing. Didn't Kevin Bacon make a movie about this? It's illegal to drink on horseback in Colorado. And just why is that? Because a horse is technically a vehicle in Colorado. In D.C., it's legal to drink in bars and walk around in bars. However, it's illegal to drink and walk around in bars. In Hawaii, it's illegal to order more than one drink at a time. You can only have one drink in front of you. In Nevada, public intoxication is legal. Surprised? But it goes further than that. No town in Nevada may pass a law against public intoxication. And Kansas, possibly the most restrictive state to alcohol in the nation. Prohibition ended in 1933. Kansas didn't actually reverse the statute until 1948. And even after 1948, if you wanted to buy a drink in a bar or a restaurant, you couldn't until 1987. Not to be outdone by Kansas, Mississippi didn't repeal prohibition until 1966. You can purchase mixed cocktails in drive-through stores in my own hometown of New Orleans, but they give them to you with a straw on the side, because a straw on the side prevents you from drinking while driving. Arizona law also permits drive-through liquor stores. It's illegal to drink on Election Day in Kentucky and South Carolina. This law probably made more sense when many polling places were set up in taverns back in the 1800s. Also in South Carolina, on the fourth Friday of October, all public schools are required to teach their students about Francis Willard, a major player in passing prohibition laws and educating on the evils of intemperance. It's illegal to give booze to a fish in Ohio. I'm not sure how one would go about doing this, but if you figure out how, don't do it in Ohio. In Utah, up until very recently, drinks had to be poured out of sight of patrons behind what was called a Zion curtain, usually a pane of frosted glass, because watching booze get poured might make you, I don't know, want to drink it. Also, while you could order 2 drinks at once, you couldn't order a double. And if you were in a restaurant and you ordered a drink, you had to order food with it. In Tennessee, you can't buy liquor and mixers in the same store. One-stop shopping is frowned upon in that state. In New Jersey, if you've been convicted of drunk driving, you cannot have vanity plates on your car for a period of 10 years. Also, it's illegal for parents to give kids under the age of 18 even a sip of alcohol. So much for teaching your kids how to drink in moderation. In New York, it's illegal to use the word saloon in a bar's name. After Michael O'Neill opened O'Neill's Saloon, the state liquor authority said he was breaking the law. So he changed the S to a B, and now, thank goodness, we have O'Neill's Balloon. In Iowa, it's illegal to run a tab. By law, you must pay for each drink as it comes, because making things more difficult is something Iowans need to specialize in. And just to prove that the feds can be just as dumb as the individual states, here's a national statute. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms bans the use of the word refreshing when describing any alcoholic beverage. So beer is brisk, gin is invigorating, and wine is really, really good. Break out the thesaurus, guys. And last but hardly least, our own state of Alaska. Until recently, it was illegal to give alcohol to a moose in Fairbanks. This law apparently dated to 1913 and was passed to address the problems generated by a local saloon owner and his pet moose. Of more immediate impact, happy hour is illegal in Alaska. By law, any liquor discounts must be in effect for an entire week. You can forget ladies' nights also. Any discount must be offered to all customers. Finally, it is illegal to be visibly intoxicated in a bar in Alaska. Come January, I'm sure Senator Pete Michiki will once again begin his seemingly never-ending struggle to reform Alaska's alcohol regulations, a project he's been working on for about a decade now. I wish him luck, but judging by the legislature's past performance, I sure wouldn't bet money on him succeeding.